This is Ann Weller with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And during the next 30 minutes, I will be sharing nutrition information with you. This information is selected from the Nutrition Action Health Letter, a publication of the Center for Science in the Public Interest, based in Washington, D.C. The Center for Science in the Public Interest was founded in 1971 by three scientists who wanted to apply their academic training to the solving of social problems. The center staff conduct innovative research and other programs in health and nutrition and provide consumers with current information about their health and well-being. An independent, nonprofit consumer health group, the center promotes honest food labeling and advertising, safer and more nutritious foods, and pro-health alcohol policies. The work of the Center for Science in the Public Interest is supported by Nutrition Action Health Letter subscribers and by foundation grants. It accepts no government or industry funding, and Nutrition Action Health Letter, which was first published in 1974, accepts no advertising. The following edition of Nutrition News is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Please use the information presented in this broadcast in consultation with your personal physician. In the cover story of the June 2012 issue of Nutrition Action Health Letter, Director of Nutrition Bonnie Liebman discusses some nutrition messages that don't seem to register or stick with many consumers. We're doing some things right. As a nation, we've cut back on sugar and soft drinks, and we replace much of our shortening with oil. We have switched from whole milk to lower fat milk, and we have swapped much of our beef for chicken. We're eating more vegetables, not counting potatoes. Clearly, some messages are getting through loud and clear, but others don't stick. Maybe that's because we haven't heard them enough, or because they are controversial. Maybe it's because there is only so much you can remember and only so much you can think about when you're deciding what to have for lunch. So here is a refresher course on some topics that may have gone in one ear and out the other. One message that doesn't seem to stick with many consumers is that extra weight increases your risk of cancer. If you asked 1,000 people why it is unhealthy to gain weight, what would you expect to hear? Maybe that extra pounds boosts your odds of getting diabetes, or a heart attack, or a stroke. Fewer people, however, would guess that excess weight may increase your risk of cancer. Yet in January, the American Cancer Society released the latest update of its guidelines on nutrition and physical activity for cancer prevention. And one of its key recommendations is, be as lean as possible throughout life without being underweight. Obesity is clearly linked to breast cancer in postmenopausal women. It's clearly linked to adenocarcinoma of the esophagus and cancers of the colon, rectum, uterus, kidney, and pancreas. Evidence is growing that obesity is also linked to cancers of the gallbladder, cancers of the liver, the cervix, and the ovary, along with non-Hodgkin lymphoma, multiple myeloma, and aggressive prostate cancer. After tobacco cessation, maintaining healthy body weight through physical activity and diet is one of the main ways that people can reduce their risk of developing cancer, says Marjorie McCullough, Strategic Director of Nutritional Epidemiology at the American Cancer Society, and co-author of the guidelines. Losing excess weight after treatment may also raise your odds of keeping some cancers, like breast, colon, and prostate, from returning, says the American Cancer Society's new Nutrition and Physical Activity Guidelines for Cancer Survivors. How? The obesity-inflammation connection is likely to be relevant for both risk and recurrence of cancer, says Andrew Dannenberg, director of the Weill Cornell Cancer Center in New York. At a recent workshop on the role of obesity in cancer survival and recurrence held by the Institute of Medicine, other culprits may also play a role. Insulin could be a major player, not just as an indicator of insulin resistance, but actually as a hormone that is driving cancer growth, suggested Derek LaRoth of the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York at the same workshop. When you're insulin resistant, your insulin does not work properly. So to prevent cancer, the American Cancer Society does not just recommend that people lose excess weight, but that they avoid putting on pounds in the first place. For most adults, a reduction of 50 to 100 calories per day may prevent gradual weight gain, says the prevention guidelines. It is so easy to inadvertently add 50 to 100 calories to your diet, notes Dr. McCullough. And it can really add up if you do the math. So it makes sense to start cutting back a little bit. That way you can stay lean rather than try to return to your old, leaner self. People who maintain a healthy weight have a lower risk of cancer than people who have gained and then lost weight, Dr. McCullough points out. So the ideal thing is not to gain in the first place. But if you're already overweight, it's still worth trying to lose. Even if you repeatedly lose and gain the weight, your risk of dying of cancer, heart disease, or other illness is no higher than that of someone who started at the same weight. Yo-yo dieting is not dangerous, says Dr. McCullough, so you might as well try to lose weight rather than to not try at all. Another message that does not seem to stick with most consumers is that subtle cues can make you eat more or less. Bet you can't eat just one, dared the classic Lay's potato chip ads. In fact, how many chips or other foods you eat may depend on cues that are below your radar. Here's a case in point. Researchers gave nearly 100 students at two colleges tubes of Lay's stackables potato chips to eat while they watched a movie. Half the students got tubes of ordinary chips, and half of the students got tubes with a red, a tomato basil flavored chip, inserted after every 4, 6, 9, or 13 ordinary chips. Students who ate from tubes with the red chip dividers cut their consumption of chips by more than 50%, says co-author Brian Wansink of Cornell University. That meant that they consumed about 250 fewer calories. Another benefit, the dividers made students much better at estimating how many potato chips they ate, notes Dr. Wansink. On average, those without red divider chips underestimated their intake by 13 chips, while those with divider chips were off by less than one chip. Dr. Wansink, author of Mindless Eating, published by Bantam in 2007, has found that all sorts of below-the-radar cues influence how much we eat. For example, people tend to consume more from larger plates and bowls than when food is visible and when food is visible and within reach. So what to do? Create your own dividers. Repackage food into small containers, bowls or baggies, suggests Dr. Wansink. Don't say, now that I know, it won't influence me. But set up your environment so that you mindlessly eat less. A third message that doesn't seem to register with many consumers is that we are eating too many grains. Too many grains? We have all heard the advice to switch to whole grains, to eat less sugar and bad fat, and to cut back on excess calories. But why fewer grains? In 1970, the average American got 430 calories a day from wheat, corn, oats, rye, and other grains. And by 2009, we were up to 620 calories a day from these sources. You can chalk up the increase to more bread, pasta, rice, tortillas, crackers, cereal, pancakes, pizza crust, pretzels, pastries, and other foods made with grain. And an estimated 90% of the grain we eat is refined flour. Refined grains are a big part of the imbalance in our diets, says Susan Krebs Smith of the National Cancer Institute, who analyzed diet data on more than 16,000 Americans. The other parts of imbalance in our diets: we eat too many servings from the meat group, which also includes poultry, fish, and eggs, and too few servings of fruits, vegetables, and low-fat dairy. We also do not come close to making at least half of our grains whole. And we eat too much of what health authorities call SOFAs, or solid fats and added sugars. Refined grains are not only consumed in excess, but they tend to be carriers of solid fats and added sugars, says Dr. Krebs Smith. They show up in grain-based desserts, cakes, cookies, grain-based chips, and snacks. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture may be too generous when it recommends 6 servings a day of grains for a 2,000-calorie diet. A serving is just 1/2 cup of cooked pasta or rice, or 1 slice of bread. The healthiest diets in the OmniHeart study, which lowered blood pressure, triglycerides, and LDL or bad cholesterol, the healthiest diets had only 4 servings of grains a day. Instead, the diet's carbs came from fruits, vegetables, and beans. However, most people get far more than 6 servings of grains a day. It's not as though people were having either extra grains or extra solid fats and added sugars, says Krebs Smith. People were having quite a bit extra of all three. Another message that does not seem to stick with many consumers is that animal protein can help, not hurt your bones. Does animal protein leach calcium from bones, as some people claim? Protein does increase calcium excretion, says Sue Shapsis, professor of nutrition at Rutgers University in New Jersey. But with a higher protein intake, there's also a higher absorption of calcium. Whether that leads to a net loss or gain in bone seems to depend on how much calcium you consume. Researchers divided more than 3,700 residents of Framingham, Massachusetts, by how much calcium they got from food and supplements. Among residents who consumed less than 800 milligrams of calcium a day, actually they averaged about 500 milligrams, those who ate the most animal protein had nearly three times the risk of a hip fracture than those who ate the least animal protein. However, among those who consumed at least 800 milligrams of calcium a day, and they averaged about 1,000 milligrams of calcium a day, those who ate the most animal protein had an 85% lower risk of a hip fracture than those who ate the least amount of animal protein. As long as there is adequate calcium, protein is good for bones, says Dr. Shapsis. Dr. Shapsis has also looked more closely at what protein does to bone in dieters. In the past, we found that there's a decrease in calcium absorption when you're dieting, she notes. And when you're dieting, you may be decreasing your calcium and protein intake, too. In a study funded by the National Institute on Aging, Dr. Shapsis and her colleagues assigned 47 overweight postmenopausal women to either a high-protein or a normal-protein diet. All the women cut 500 to 600 calories a day and got 1,200 milligrams a day of calcium from food and supplements. They also received 400 international units of vitamin D. And the protein came mostly from fish, lean meat, poultry, beans, and dairy foods. After 1 year, the high-protein group lost less bone from the hip, spine, and wrist. And these are high-risk sites for fracture. Dr. Shapsis adds, I think the results would be even more significant in older people. Fractures do not generally begin until after 70 years of age, so they were still a youngish group for osteoporosis. The average age in this group was 58. And older people may not eat enough protein, notes Dr. Shapsis. That can lead to loss of muscle, too. Even the women in her study had trouble getting enough protein. Our goal was to have the higher protein group get 30% of their calories from protein, but they only reached 24%, says Dr. Shapsis. They averaged 86 grams of protein a day, while the normal protein group got 18% of their calories from protein, or 60 grams a day. Dr. Shapsis' bottom line, getting about 25% of your calories from protein seems like a good target in order to reduce bone loss. Many consumers may not be getting the message that eating 3,500 fewer calories does not mean that you will lose a pound. If you Google how many calories are in a pound, you'll get something like 11 million hits, and they all basically say the same thing, explained Kevin Hall at the 2012 annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Vancouver in February. They all say there's 3,500 calories in a pound, continued Dr. Hall, who is an obesity researcher and physicist at the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases. For decades, people have used the 3,500 calorie rule to to estimate how much weight they will lose. The usual assumption is, if you cut, say, 500 calories a day from your diet, said Dr. Hall, then after a week, I'm going to get 1 pound of weight change, and that will keep going forever. But that's not what happens. The 3,500 calorie rule assumes that there's going to be no change in the number of calories that you are expending, said Dr. Hall. In fact, the body starts burning fewer calories as you lose weight. The resting metabolic rate drops, Dr. Hall noted. The resting metabolic rate is the rate at which your body burns calories to keep you alive at rest. And it accounts for 60 to 75% of the calories that a typical person burns. When you lose weight, your resting metabolic rate drops because your body thinks you are starving. So it tries to burn fewer calories. And that's not all. The physical activity cost also drops, added Dr. Hall. That's because your body does not need to burn as many calories to move the new, lighter you. So what happens if you do not just cut calories, but get out and walk or run a few miles every day? Let's say I start cranking up my physical activity and start burning a lot more calories, said Dr. Hall. In some people, that is going to cause them to eat more, and our model does not know how much that's going to be, because in other people, that's going to cause them to eat less. In carefully controlled studies where people participate in supervised exercise, weight loss varies. The studies see this large range of weight changes from people who gain weight to people who lose more weight than would be expected, said Dr. Hall. The bottom line, do not expect to lose weight quickly. We have a new weight loss rule of thumb, which is 10 calories per day per pound of weight change, said Dr. Hall. About half of this weight change will occur after 1 year, and about 95% of the weight change will occur after 3 years. So, if you want to lose, say, 10 pounds, you have to permanently cut 100 calories a day. And after a year, you will have lost 5 of the 10 pounds, and after 3 years, you will have lost nearly all 10 pounds. Many consumers are also not getting the message that we do not get enough potassium. So how much potassium are you supposed to get? The recommended dietary allowance is 4,700 milligrams a day, and the average American gets roughly half that much. And potassium matters. Many randomized trials have shown that an increase in potassium intake lowers blood pressure, says Graham McGregor, professor of cardiovascular medicine at the London School of Medicine and Dentistry. But potassium may do more than help blood pressure. For 4 weeks, McGregor and his colleagues gave an extra 2,500 milligrams of potassium a day, or a placebo, to 42 people with high blood pressure. These people were already getting about 2,200 milligrams of potassium from their food. The participants' arteries were less stiff when they got the extra potassium than when they got the placebo. People with stiffer arteries have a higher risk of heart attacks, strokes, and memory loss. What's more, they also had less thickening of the heart muscle when they were given potassium. A thicker muscle around the left ventricle, or left ventricular hypertrophy, is linked to a higher risk of heart disease. The left ventricle is the chamber of the heart that pumps oxygen-rich blood throughout the body. High blood pressure and left ventricular hypertrophy are both important risk factors for heart failure, says Dr. McGregor, who heads World Action on Salt and Health, which is working to gradually reduce salt intake in 85 countries. In a U.S. study of 1,000 healthy young adults without high blood pressure, those who consumed more potassium and less sodium also had less thickening of the heart muscle. The best way to increase potassium intake is to increase the consumption of fruits and vegetables, says Dr. McGregor. Why? Fruits and vegetables have other nutrients that may lower blood pressure, and they displace foods with more saturated fat and cholesterol. The OmniHeart diets, which lowered blood pressure and LDL or bad cholesterol, included 11 half-cup servings of fruits and vegetables a day. And don't forget salt for the most effective blood pressure control. Reduce sodium intake and increase potassium intake, says Dr. McGregor. And don't expect vitamins to prevent cancer. With bone and breast health support, says one-a-day women's formula multivitamins box, supplementing with selenium may decrease your prostate cancer risk, says the General Nutrition Center's website. General Nutrition Center provides the information as a service, but does not endorse it, notes the site. The information comes from Aisle 7, an integrated wellness marketing firm that promises to drive in-store sales. How convenient. In fact, few studies have found that multivitamins, selenium, or other supplements prevent cancer. Yet half of all U.S. adults take them. Undoubtedly, use of vitamins and other supplements is driven by a common belief that supplements can improve health and protect against disease, and that at worst they are harmless, wrote five cancer researchers in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute in April. So far, it appears that most supplements are neither harmful nor helpful. Just remember, when you see claims that a vitamin maintains a healthy prostate or supports breast health, what that really means is that there is no good evidence that the vitamin lowers the risk of prostate or breast cancer. We've reached the conclusion of this month's segment of Nutrition News. The show will be rebroadcast this week on Friday at 11 p.m. and on Saturday at 3 p.m. And please join me for the next edition of Nutrition News, which will air on Wednesday, September 5th, 2012. I'm Ann Weller, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and I hope you've enjoyed the show. The program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next month.